for refugees and migrants trying to reach Europe. Samos Island is one of several Greek islands located in the Mediterranean Sea and is a key crossing point for migrants and refugees arriving from Turkey in dangerous sea journeys.
Regarding the restrictions in the camp, they are very limiting for us, especially in terms of entering and exiting. The time restriction for leaving and entering is from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., and after 9 p.m., entry into the camp is not allowed. The second restriction is the tax on passports. Some people are unable to pay this tax, and there are individuals who have completed all their procedures. But the only obstacle left is paying this tax. Moreover, there are severe consequences for not paying the passport fee. If this tax is not paid, the entire process is halted, and no assistance is provided in any way. The procedure must then be restarted from the beginning, which is a major obstacle for those who have received approval for asylum.
Humanitarian organizations provide medical care in refugee camps and areas experiencing conflicts, such as treatment for infectious diseases, first aid, surgical treatment for injuries resulting from conflicts, and treatment for war-related injuries. Psychological care and support. Due to the harsh conditions faced by refugees, organizations provide psychological support and counseling to help them overcome the psychological trauma caused by wars or displacement. The organization works to provide vaccinations to prevent diseases that may spread in refugee areas, such as measles and cholera, through organized vaccination campaigns. Detention and refugee centers in Samos suffer from severe overcrowding, where many refugees and migrants are detained for long periods, creating inhumane conditions. These individuals often face difficulty in accessing basic healthcare, psychological care, and adequate food. Before the establishment of the new camp or detention center on the Greek island of Samos, the situation for refugees there was extremely difficult. They lived in harsh conditions in the old camp near the town of Vathi, which suffered from severe overcrowding. The old camp was originally designed to accommodate around 650 people, but at times housed more than 7,000 refugees. Many refugees were forced to live in inadequate tents in the areas surrounding the camp, adding to their suffering. Additionally, there was a shortage of clean drinking water and sanitation, leading to the spread of diseases. Other challenges included long queues for food with insufficient rations, a lack of healthcare services, leaving refugees with untreated medical issues. Frequent violence and clashes, both among refugees and between them and the police. Weak protection for women and children, with reports of harassment and even assaults. Extremely long waiting periods, sometimes lasting years, before receiving decisions on asylum applications. This delay increased frustration and made life in the camp even more difficult. What happened next? The new closed camp was opened in September 2021, offering better infrastructure, but operating under strict surveillance, similar to detention centres. This has sparked widespread controversy among human rights organisations.
The volume of the need for health medical consultation is really high, because it's not just a population that is stable in a camp. It's a population that is turning. The turnover is very high. You've got hundreds of people leaving every month, being transferred to another camp, and then hundreds of people arriving and in need of new consultation. So we have a team of doctors, and we try to provide this consultation, but we also have limited capacity. And ultimately, there is a state responsibility to provide medical care to those people. It's a state's responsibility, but it's also a responsibility that comes from the EU and the European leaders. So that is really a one-man challenge, the volume and the need for primary health care. Another challenge is also the referral in case of specialized care. On some islands, There is no access to some specialized care. There is no psychiatric care, for example, or there is no access to certain infectious disease treatments such as HIV, tuberculosis, or hepatitis. That means that when we identify someone that is in need for specialized care that is not available on the island, then we have to liaise with the authority to organize a timely transfer so the person can actually receive the care needed. And this also can be sometimes a little bit complicated.
In 2024 in Samos, we assisted more than 2,400 people arriving, and we have witnessed stressful and very distressed as arriving of the people, psychological and medical issues mainly resulting from their severe experiences during their journey, but also as well pregnant women who need of emergency medical care.
Number of administrative challenges, but they're faced mostly, or our patients face a number of administrative challenges, and therefore indirectly when trying to provide them or trying to support them to receiving medical care, then we are also faced with those challenges. It really often comes to bureaucratic barriers, difficulty to register someone, or legal barriers as well. In terms of access, we've had challenges in the past, absolutely. It's been actually better recently. No one has a crystal ball to say what the future holds, really. I think we need hope in whatever situation. And I also think that actually hope, as I was saying earlier, the instinct for life actually is very, very strong, and it's part of the human nature. But I think we need to be under no illusion, because when you look at the already with actually numbers that are not that high, when you look at how the system is overwhelmed and struggling to actually uphold with the basic assistance and services that people need, and then you look at the broader international context at the moment with the an increased restrictive frame for migration in general. You have a rise of anti-migrant narratives all over the world. So I think we also need to hope for the best, but prepare for the worst.
Many young people and families from Arab countries seek refuge in Europe due to wars, poverty, repression, and political instability in Middle Eastern countries caused by Israeli colonization in Palestine, supported by the United States and the European Union. Israel's occupation has extended to encroach on neighboring countries like Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, which poses a real threat to these countries, delaying their economic and developmental progress. This spreads poverty and unemployment, pushing young people to migrate to support their families. These migrants attempt to reach Europe via the Mediterranean Sea, a perilous journey. Unfortunately, this situation results in the loss of many lives and reflects the extent of desperation felt by these migrants under the current conditions.
The greenest way I offer you, the sweetest bird song I offer you. They say that love strikes only once. That precious moment I offer you. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest rose? You are my guiding light that walks me through the night. Your presence gives me strength, gives vision to my sight. Someday faith will increase, someday our wars will cease, someday there'll be just. I possess, I offer you. I want to be someone whom you can trust. Come save us from a world that's so unjust. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, protecting the women. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on I'm Being Shreya with me, Sister Zainab. And look, the topic of protecting the women, so this is something very special in Islam, that obviously we should be giving special consideration to women, because obviously Islam recognizes that women have a nature that is different to that of men. So women are sort of made more sort of emotional, more sensitive, and this is actually a strength that actually complements the sort of different nature of men. And that means that obviously behavior towards women should actually be different in some situations than it would be towards men. And obviously we know that obviously the Holy Prophet said, you know, if we have asked, you know, who do we consider first? It's always, you know, the mother, before even the father, for example. In particular sort of situations, what does this mean? And I just want to refer to something from life of one of the famous martyrs of the whole defense by the name of Said Can Bozorgi. So this is a very specific context. So he had a very difficult operation to face because he had serious injuries from the holy defense. Now, he did not tell his mother or his wife what the precise reason for this operation was. So he gave them one reason. He said it was for such and such, but he didn't give them the actual reason. So he just said that there was some sort of shrapnel or something. In fact, there was actually a tumor. But he didn't tell the female members of his family. And obviously, so why did he do that? That is because he knew. So obviously, especially the mother would have been in tremendous sort of worry about her son, and as would his wife would have been in tremendous worry for her husband. Welcome back to A to Z here on Iron Ridge Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and I'm talking about a particular situation, a context in which we sort of protect women in the case of the martyr Said Can Bozorgi, I've just mentioned, did not inform his mother or his wife of the seriousness of the operation he was about to undergo. And, you know, maybe in your own lives you've actually witnessed something like this, and it might even go beyond even protecting the women. Some of you might have even sort of kept a particular operation or illness or something from other people so as not to, let's say, worry them. You know, this doesn't necessarily have to be the most serious sort of illness operation. It could even be maybe you have the flu or something else, and you know, you sort of keep it to yourself. Maybe, you know, maybe you're not, let's say, next to your parents. Maybe the parents don't live in the same town. And maybe when you're speaking with your parents, or let's say especially your mother, you don't tell your mother that, you know, that this is a very serious flu, or that maybe you, a couple of years back at least, that you got COVID, because you don't want to cause undue worry, not to your father, and especially not to your mother. So, you know, you keep it to yourself, unless it really gets to that level where you have to, because it's extremely serious. And I wouldn't be surprised if many of us actually have little stories like that to tell. And, you know, again, people, I very well remember one neighbour who ultimately died of cancer. And she did not say a thing to anyone. We only found out what had happened was when she'd actually died. And, you know, and she had just been beautifully friendly, and no one knew, basically. But she was going through all this on her own, and probably not even sort of informing many of her friends, and maybe also just not wanting to cause undue worry, because some people, we, you know, we just don't want to cause stress to others. We don't want them to worry. And obviously, yes, protecting the women. So let's see if we can just sort of bear that in mind, and see if we can, in our daily lives, just always remember that we should be treating the women just a little bit differently, and just have a little bit more consideration, inshallah. So that was it for today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of HZ here on Iron Bingish Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
The world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Good morning to all the listeners from around the world. You are tuned in to Iran Radio for the next hour. We start this hour's lineup with a spotlight, a daily program which covers the most important events happening in the world today. Q&A on Islamic beliefs follows next. The program provides answers to listeners' questions about Islamic beliefs. Stay with us for the next hour.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of Spotlight. For decades, Europe was told it had a reliable partner across the Atlantic, a defender of a rules-based order. But now that promise lies broken and exposed as a lie. The so-called peace plan unveiled by Donald Trump is more than just a proposal to end the war in Ukraine. It is a stunning act of unilateral force, drafted in secret and presented to Europe as a finished deal they had no choice but to accept. Washington, in its arrogance, kept both Kiev and its European allies entirely in the dark on matters that directly threaten their very security. This is not diplomacy. It is a dictated peace. It is a plan that reads like a list of concessions to the Kremlin, demanding Ukraine surrender its sovereignty, its territory, and its future. And it comes with a threat: sign or face the consequences. Tonight we ask, is this the end of the Atlantic Alliance? Has the United States under Trump become not a partner but a danger to European security? And how will Europe and a besieged Ukraine respond to this brutal new reality? But first, let's get more details in this report.
Ukraine's European allies are holding talks on the sideline of the G20 summit over Trump's proposed peace plan to end the Ukraine war. In a joint statement, they described the proposal as unilateral, saying that it requires additional work. They expressed concern over the proposed limitations on Ukraine's armed forces, saying it leaves the country vulnerable to future attacks.
The war can only end with Ukraine's unconditional consent. Wars cannot be ended by major powers over the heads of the countries involved. Rather, this is a war that can only end with Ukraine's consent and with our consent, the consent of the European Union, because it is a war on the European continent.
Kiev has also rejected key elements of the plan. The Ukrainian president's office said the country will never be an obstacle to peace, but emphasized that its representatives would continue to defend the legitimate interests of the Ukrainian people. President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned that Ukraine is facing one of the most difficult moments in its history.
Now is one of the most difficult moments in our history. Now the pressure on Ukraine is one of the most difficult. Now Ukraine may find itself facing a very difficult choice: either the loss of dignity or the risk of losing a key partner. We did not betray Ukraine then, we will not do it now. And I know for sure that in this truly one of the most difficult moments in our history, I am not alone.
Neighboring Poland also expressed firm opposition, insisting that any peace agreement must be accepted by Kiev and that Ukrainians themselves must have a central role in negotiations. The White House has denied that Ukraine was sidelined, but skepticism in Europe remains high. Trump, meanwhile, has escalated pressure on Kiev, warning that Ukraine would lose additional territory in a short amount of time if it refused the plan, and declaring that Zelensky is going to have to approve it.
Well, he'll have to like it, and if he doesn't like it, then, you know, they should just keep fighting, I guess, you know.
The U.S. president said he had given Ukraine until Thursday to agree to the plan. According to widely leaked drafts, the U.S. plan includes several concessions Ukraine has previously ruled out. These include recognizing Crimea, Luhansk, and Donetsk as de facto Russian, obliging Ukraine to constitutionally renounce NATO membership, and reducing Ukraine's armed forces to 600,000 troops. Additional provisions would bar NATO troop deployments in Ukraine. The text also outlines steps for Russia's reintegration into the global economy and its return to the G8. For many European governments, the episode has exposed a far deeper worry. A peace plan drafted behind closed doors, unveiled as a near-final document, and built around sweeping concessions to Moscow, has intensified the sense that Washington under Trump is no longer behaving like a dependable ally. European officials say the administration bypassed NATO entirely, kept key European capitals in the dark about provisions that directly affect their own security, and excluded Ukraine, the country at the center of the war, from any meaningful role in shaping its terms. For Europe, the episode is a blunt reminder that under Trump, the United States is prepared to act unilaterally on matters central to Europe's security, even if its closest allies are left entirely out of the room.
Well, to analyze these new developments, we are joined by Mr. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joining us from Fredericton, Canada. And Mr. John Stepling, author and commentator, joining us from Inderøy, Norway. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank both of you very much for joining us during this episode of Spotlight, of course. Mr. Bosnich, let's go ahead and start off with you, please. Let's start off with this U.S. unilateralism. Now, the Trump administration completely bypassed the NATO and the key European capitals in drafting this plan. Does this prove or at least signal that the transatlantic alliance is indeed finished?
Well, the transatlantic alliance, as we euphemistically call it, was never an alliance. It was an empire ruled from Washington with some advisors from London. And the rest of the countries across the mainland of Europe, were merely cannon fodder for an anticipated war against the Soviet Union. So this whole charade of a partnership, of an alliance, of America's partners not being satisfied that they weren't consulted, that is, to use the initials, that is complete BS. There is nothing that the European so-called partners have ever been able to say to Washington. Washington has always been their controllers, and what's happening today with respect to Ukraine is an example of how Washington crushes opposing opinions among its federated military colonies. That's the straight story about what's happening.
Well, with that, let's go ahead and cross over to Mr. Stepling. Mr. Stepling, as we just now heard from Mr. Bosnich, I mean, basically the truth of what the U.S. is, what many people around the world know what the U.S. is, other than, of course, mainstream media, what they imply on what the U.S. is. This plan was presented, as we had mentioned, as a final document and, of course, not even as a starting point for negotiations. When it comes to the situation about Trump saying take it or leave it, what does this reveal about the U.S. and how it's using its power under Trump, or has this actually always been the situation with the U.S.? Or is it basically that Trump is just more clear about it?
Well, let's remember, firstly, that the U.S., began interfering in Russian elections all the way back in 1996. They made a Hollywood movie about it called Spinning Boris. Then there was 2014, the Maidan coup, completely orchestrated by the U.S., State Department, CIA. The U.S. has been meddling in all of this from the beginning. They kept moving NATO eastward. So this idea that somehow giving Donbass to Russia is an example of caving in to the dictator Putin, this is nonsense. Does everybody forget for 7 years Donbass was bombed? It's predominantly ethnically Russian, Russian-speaking, and they were bombed by Kiev, terrorized by Kiev. People just seem to have this complete amnesia about this stuff. It's stunning. But the other thing is, we keep hearing in all of this, well, European security is threatened. Is somebody thinking that Russia is going to invade Norway or Spain or something anytime soon? Because they're not. They have no interest in trying to occupy a European country. I mean, this is farcical. It's pure fantasy. So yes, the U.S. acts unilaterally, but they always have. They just gave it a cosmetic treatment that made it appear democratic many times. But of course NATO is run by the U.S. All policy decisions coming out of NATO have always been carried out by the U.S., carried out in Washington. So what we're seeing also, though, with European leadership, people like Jens Stoltenberg and Merz in Germany and Macron and the Finns and the Estonians, is this rabid Russophobia. And I always hearken back to the dismantling of Yugoslavia, because that was a lesson that people seem to not have learned how that was carried out. That was the last nominally socialist state in Europe, and the U.S. had to see it crushed. the European leadership went along with that enthusiastically because there was money to be made. And so now we're seeing all of this saber rattling from European leadership and from Brussels, van der Leyen and Miss Callas. You know, and they have no leverage. They rattle sabers that are made of paper mache. So it's the whole thing just strikes me as comical at this point.
Well, Mr. Stepling, I mean, as you're talking, I can definitely see Mr. Bosnich nodding and grinning in agreement, I believe. But Mr. Bosnich, I mean, you guys both mentioned the situation with the U.S., how history has basically shown. I do want to ask you, Mr. Bosnich, in relation to President Zelensky himself. Now, he spoke about this choice between losing dignity or losing a partner. Where does he fit in with all of this? I mean, the way that things have been playing specifically on media.
Well, first of all, this is whatever he says is what's being written for him by his CIA scriptwriters. The CIA organized through corrupt oligarchs in post-communist Ukraine. They organized the transfer of money to Ukraine to create Zelensky. So I appreciate the remarks of my fellow commentator today about people don't seem to learn lessons, or they don't at least remember lessons from the past, but you can't remember what you never learned. And the lying mainstream media, plus the totally dysfunctional educational system in the West, has hidden the fact that from the end of World War II, the United States and England especially have been active in Ukraine. In the 1940s and 50s, they recruited former Waffen-SS officers to run guerrilla operations in Ukraine. They then recruited many exiled Ukrainians and brought them into the State Department and planned these actions decades ago. My father was an acquaintance of Zbig Brzezinski, who went to university with him in Canada. He visited Zbig in 1978 in the White House when they discussed the upcoming plan for the disruption of Ukraine. And this was even before the Soviet Union collapsed. So there is nothing new under the sun, and certainly not in Ukraine. As for Zelensky is literally nothing other than a paid actor who was selected by his boss, the oligarch Kolomoisky, who has run off to Israel to hide, who worked for the CIA. And this is the final act of a very sorry and bloodthirsty tale written in Washington in the late 1940s as they looked at what resources they might have beyond the Iron Curtain, and they looked to former Nazis and they recruited them. And that's the explanation for why we've seen so many Ukrainian soldiers with SS and swastika tattoos burned into their bodies by their own choice. This reality is what is coming to the fore. And there's nobody in the EU who doesn't realize this. And all of their crocodile tears that they're crying now about, Russia did this and America is telling us what to do, all of that is another example of acting by players who knew for years that this was coming up and that if they failed, they would have to disavow it. Nothing more. A PSYOP operated from Washington and running as a boat of death on the blood of Slavs, both Ukrainians and Russians, because it's a no-lose situation for Washington. If they can make the Ukrainian and Russian brothers hate each other for the next 20 or 30 years, they will have achieved one of their primary goals.
Well, Mr. Stepling, I mean, the plan, as we were mentioning, reportedly forces Ukraine to give up any hope of joining the NATO. Now, what would you tell viewers and people around the world that are saying, isn't this basically handing Putin his biggest victory on a silver platter, coincidentally being delivered by an American partner? Where is Putin in all of this, and Russia, of course?
Well, I mean, Russia won the war. This tends to be what happens when you win a war. But again, remember that this was a corrupt regime in Kiev before Zelensky that was bombing the Donbass, which is predominantly Russian. They talk about the illegal annexation of Crimea. There was, in fact, a referendum. But these points have long historic tales behind them. You can't really understand it unless, as John pointed out, you go back to World War II and the end of World War II. But beyond that, what Ukraine right now is primarily objecting to in this peace plan is not giving up territory, is not losing any hope of joining NATO. They were terrified about this audit that was going to happen because they obviously are corrupt and stole dozens of billions of dollars that they have no way of explaining the disappearance. And it went into the pockets of oligarchs and Zelensky's pals and into Zelensky's pocket. And the thing is, everybody knows this. I mean, we're seeing, it's not, Zelensky's not the only actor here. I mean, we see these performances from European leaders as if the Russian hordes are assembling at the gates to the European civilization and they're about to break through and march down the Champs-Élysées or something. I mean, Russia has enough on its plate. It's going to be quite happy to just wrap this up and hopefully get some relief from sanctions and so forth. But they have no imperialist ambition whatsoever. I mean, this is just ludicrous. So John's right. This was Washington wanting to put a ribbon on it, get done with it. Russia won the war. It's over. It's been over for 8-10 months. There was, you know, it was a complete waste of life for the last 10 months. They have been shanghaiing men off the street in Ukraine to use as cannon fodder, throwing them into this meat grinder. And you know, it's the typical story of war. The rich get richer. Defense contractors made a lot of money, so it was prolonged as long as it was possible, and now it's not possible. And as I say, Ukraine's biggest fear right now, the Zelensky administration's fear, is that they don't want an audit. The rest of it, they don't care about. This was, you know, Crimea and Donbass was lost a long time ago. So this is, of course, written and scripted by Washington, because most everything in the world is these days. And this is no exception. I mean, I predict Zelensky will end up with a late night talk show in Miami. And that's probably where, you know, that was his past and that's going to be his future.
And Mr. Bosnich, what do you have in regards to what Mr. Stepling said? Do you believe that the war in Russia-Ukraine is finally over and this is the ending?
Well, I'm actually more optimistic than he is. I think the war will continue. And the reason why I say that's optimistic is because I think that although Russia is prepared to have a peace agreement at this time, Zelensky is not. Because the people who pay Zelensky are telling him, listen, puppet, you're going to do what we say, or you are not going to be alive in a very short period of time. And so for Zelensky, it's a matter of life and death. And if he were ever to show up, as my fellow commentator says, in a talk show in Florida, it would be in the same cell as the Americans stuck their former collaborator Noriega, or wherever they stick any one of their tin pot puppet dictators once he's no longer useful to them. And the sad fact of this matter is that the Ukrainian people were deceived. Their lying mainstream media in Ukraine worked for a Hollywood script to create the servant of the people, who was no such thing. Zelensky was a servant of the CIA. That's the movie that needs to be made from his jail cell in Florida when he finally gets there, if he lives long enough to get there. This is a picture of the reality of the totally corrupt Anglo-American empire in play all the time for not just the past, you know, 3 years of this war. But for the entire period, for the 11 years since the United States staged the fake coup d'etat in Kiev that brought to power the entire gang behind Zelensky. And I'm glad that the other commentator today mentioned Yugoslavia, because I don't know if I've mentioned it before, but I was an advisor to former President Milosevic when he was kidnapped and taken to The Hague. My family comes from Yugoslavia, and I was living until recently and will be returning to Serbia, the center of the former Yugoslavia. And what has happened in Ukraine is transparent to me and those of us who lived through the Yugoslav operation, because it's identical. They set up a fake group of puppets. Those puppets were corrupt and stole money. They were removed and replaced by other puppets, and you have the disaster zone that is known as Serbia today, with people marching for a year against a corrupt, totally criminal government. This is what always happens when you get crooks like the CIA and you dress them up in a suit and tie and pretend that they are statesmen. These are not statesmen. They are having no more success than putting lipstick on a pig.
Exactly, as you did mention, dressing up in suit and a tie is something we've seen in Syria and others recently, specifically. Mr. Steplin, we do have a few more minutes. I'd like to direct this question towards you. Under the Trump administration, under the U.S. specific last few years, I mean, the global system has been replaced. Has it been replaced in a system we now live in, which is basically a jungle where only threats and force matter?
Well, let me try to answer that in a slightly circuitous way, but apropos of what John said, I was part of the committee to defend Milosevic, actually, and was in Serbia a couple of times during that period, and the U.S., as is always the case, was aligned with the fascists, the Croat fascists that go back to World War II. The people that constructed the Jasenovac concentration camp and so forth. The United States is never on the side of democracy. They weren't in Latin America, or in Africa. They fought against African independence. They are always on the side of dictators, because dictators are easier to control. Zelensky fits this to a T. But the idea that we're now in a jungle, we have always been in a jungle. I mean, this is Western imperialism, and the West is prone to coercive measures whenever they can. I mean, we look at the dying empire today, though, because the U.S. keeps threatening, for example, Venezuela, but they can't really invade Venezuela because their power has waned considerably. And the only thing that has changed with Trump is that he sort of has done away with the middleman, and he just cuts to the chase. But all these European leaders are flailing about, and they simply have no leverage. They have nothing to back up this. Macron was talking about the French are ready to go to Ukraine and fight. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's going to happen. I mean, I don't mean to laugh at this, but I don't know another response that makes sense. This is U.S. imperialism. It's as it has existed for 70 years, and it's no different. The end is, whether John is right or I am right about exactly how long Zelensky can stay alive and occupy his presidential suites, I don't know. He is beholden to the Azov Battalion people, the far right fascists in Ukraine. They may want to take him out at a certain point. They clearly, those people are going to feel betrayed, certainly. But this was inevitable a year ago. This was inevitable. It was just going to be a matter of how and when and exactly what the terms of the so-called peace were going to look like. And they pretty much have ended up as most of us, I think, saw they were going to.
Well, on that point, I'd like to thank both of my guests, of course, for this very interesting discussion on this episode of Spotlight. From Fredericton, Canada, journalist, activist, and political analyst, Mr. John Bosnich. And, of course, as always, Mr. John Stepling, author and commentator. They're joining us from Indore, Norway. A pleasure to have you both. Until next time, goodbye.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
الله هو ذا الرحمن الله هو ذا المنان.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. You might find it Q&A on Islamic Beliefs in our website, iranradio.ir. I am Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have Sheikh Karimi to answer today's questions. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, we know that wishing for death or expecting death to come is a reprehensible or makruh act in Islam. From the other side, we might have some narrations talking about, for instance, why my death isn't coming, or for example, Lady Fatima al-Zahra, peace be upon her, did so. I'm not sure about it, okay? And I know that death might be a different concept in the eyes of an ordinary man or woman like us and a holy lady like Lady Fatima al-Zahra, okay?
Yeah.
So first of all, talk a little bit about the authenticity of this news. Really, did Lady Fatima al-Zahra ask for death, we can say, to come to her, or the story was something different?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is a famous story among the people, among the Shia, that Lady Zahra, salamullahi alayha, she wished for death. Referring to the books of narrations, as far as I have checked, there are two instances in which our books of narrations and history, they refer to this point, but we need to analyze these two cases to see if really Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha wished for death.
Mm-hmm.
And if even she wished for this, she wished for death, what does it mean?
Yes.
There are two cases. One of them is mentioned in the famous Khutbah Fadakiyah,
mm-hmm.
the sermon that Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha delivered in Medina. And this is a very great sermon of Lady Zahra salamun alayha, full of, points regarding Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, regarding her father, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family, regarding imamate, and also her right to Fadak. And alhamdulillah, it's been translated into English language. Our dear listeners, if they are interested, they can find it online. So in one part, Lady Zahra salamun alayha, she says the following. So this is a famous khutbah, sermon of Lady Zahra salamun alayha, mentioned in different books. For example, people, our dear listeners, can refer to Al-Ihtijaj, Ala Ahl al-Lajaj, by the late Shia scholar Tabrasi, volume 1, page 107. This part that I'm quoting. She says, Laytani mittu qabla hani'ati. Now, the literal translation of this sentence, so Lady Zahra salamun alayha talks about all the afflictions that befell her and all the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. And after mentioning that, she says, Laytani mittu qabla hani'ati. I wish I had died, at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
So many people have understood this, that Lady Zahra salamun alayha is now wishing for death in the real sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that this sentence, Laytani mittu qabla hada, I wish I had died before this, it can be a metaphor in Arabic language.
Right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes when you are suffering from too many afflictions, we know that all the afflictions that befell the Ahlul Bayt, first of all, it began with the demise of the Prophet himself, and then the right of Imam Ali alayhi salam to caliphate is usurped. The land of Fadak is usurped. And although the stories that happened to Imam Ali alayhi salam and Lady Zahra salamuna alayha after the demise of the Prophet, so having gone through all these difficulties,
yes,
when a person like Lady Zahra salamuna alayha says, "Laytani mittu qabla hani'ati," I wish I had died, it doesn't mean that I really wish for death today.
Mm-hmm.
No, it is, I believe, it's a kind of metaphor,
mm-hmm,
to refer to the great affliction that
and the emotional pain is over there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, I believe that, for example, you're the only daughter of, we can't say, it's better to say, that's right, the most famous daughter of, for example, Prophet Muhammad. And then at the same time, so Prophet Muhammad dies, and then all those events took place, okay? So in such an emotional pain, we can't say, you might say such a sentence.
And it doesn't mean that she's saying that out of, ordinary people,
yes,
emotion.
Or wishing for death.
Yeah, and wishing, yeah, for death. I mean, it's a metaphor in Arabic language.
Yes.
I mean, today, I mean, when a mother, for example, she's too much tired of her children,
yes,
she may say that, but she really doesn't wish for death.
Mm-hmm.
She's just referring to the trials and to the problems.
Mm-hmm.
So my point is that Lady Zahra Salman alayha, by saying that, I mean, she's the daughter of the Prophet, as you mentioned, all the people know about his status. So when he says, "Laytani mittu qabla hada," she's referring to the greatness of the events,
mm-hmm,
okay?
Mm-hmm.
Not really she's wishing for death, na'udhu billah, for example, to die,
yeah,
at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
This is my understanding of this narration. The second case is mentioned by Allama Majlisi in Biharul Anwar, volume 43, page 177.
Yes.
In which Lady Zahra Salamuna alayha says in a supplication, "Ya Ilahi, O Allah, ajjil wafati sarihan." And this is a famous sentence mentioned by some eulogists.
That's right.
When it comes to the martyrdom days of Imam of Lady Zahra Salamuna alayha, that "Ajjil wafati sarihan," O Allah, hasten my demise.
But in reality, when you look at the historical facts, it also took place. I mean, it did not take so long.
It didn't,
lady,
but now the question is that whether,
yeah,
Lady Zahra Salman alayha wished for death or not. These,
okay,
are two different,
right,
stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was martyred when she was about 18 years. This is a famous idea. According to Ahl Sunnah, she passed away when,
yes,
she was around 26, 27.
Yes.
The other idea among Shia scholars is about 21, 22.
Right.
These are
between
the
18
viewpoints
to 23.
Yeah,
that's
between,
right,
18 and 27,
okay,
28.
But the case about this
narration,
right,
that "Ya Ilahi Hajjil Wafati Sarihan,"
mm-hmm,
this is a famous narration, but the point is that narrating this, Allama Majlisi himself says, "Wajadtu fi ba'd al-kutub khabaran fi wafatiham," I saw a report in some books about the demise of Lady Zahra Salamullah alayha, فَأَحْبَبْتُ إِرَادَهُ وَإِنْ لَمْ أَخُذْ مِنْ أَسْلٍ يُعَوَّلُ عَلَيْهِ. I would like to mention that narration, although I did not find it in an authentic book.
Yes.
So the narration in which the sentence "Hajjal Wafati Sarihan" is mentioned is not authentic at all. Even according to Allama Majlisi himself,
mm-hmm,
he says that I'm quoting this, but I did not find it in an authentic work,
okay,
authentic source. So my conclusion for this part of answer is that the first narration, which is mentioned in Khutbah Fadakiya, it may not mean real wish for death.
All
it
right.
might be a metaphor. The second one, the more famous one,
okay,
is not mentioned in an authentic narration.
Yes.
So we cannot say that for sure Lady Zahra Salamun Alayha had wished for
That's
a
right.
real death.
And we must know that Fadakiya sermon was issued by Lady Zahra in a context in which she was not satisfied,
yeah,
with the deviations
exactly.
that took place from the right path of Prophet Muhammad. So sometimes your wish for death might be for sacrifice for the religion of Islam too. And in terms of, we can say, complaining about the situation in which you are in.
That's a very good point. Yeah.
I mean, right after Prophet Muhammad passes away, so we could see there are so many deviations in the path of Prophet Muhammad. And Lady Zahra is an eyewitness to all of these cases, okay? You see, oh, may I die? and not see such a condition for the religion of Islam.
Very good point. And that is why some scholars believe that, you know, that Imam that Lady Zahra Salman Aliha did a lot to defend wilaya and imamate after the demise of the Prophet. She did a lot.
Okay.
From going to the houses of the Ansar and talking to the women, khutbah fadakiyah. And some people believe that in the